3 o'clock, the hour of the wolf. Subconscious opens up. All right, well, welcome to our last day. How many folks here have been here through all of them? Not looking for brownie points, but just looking at how much continuity we were building on. All right, lovely. How many folks are here for their first time? They haven't been to any of our sessions. Okay, great, because we would not be able to repeat everything. So here's what we were thinking for this week. We knew that some folks would be leaving on buses, either for the third or fourth day. And so we didn't want today to be the buried thunder. So we wanted to make sure some of our main content got out. I don't know why the screen keeps going dark so quickly. I'm going to just keep wiggling my finger here. So what we wanted to do is create for today two things. The title is Getting Started in Your Context. And so we're going to workshop a little bit how we started yesterday, both ways, the practices of descent, of going in. And Chris not only is one who is, Chris Odie is one who is a director of Living Stones, helping folks go in. But Chris will share a little more of his experience as prison chaplains, which are really religious coordinators, right? And how you can work with the gatekeepers inside the system. Few of them will be as cool as Chris. To start new programs going in, and to think about what you might like to do going in. And then we'll, for the resurrection part, Alex and I will be talking a little bit more about how you can start One Parish, One Prisoner as soon as you get down the mountain. So that's part of it, getting started in your context. But we also wanted to leave some space for Q&A, knowing that there's some bigger questions that aren't always handled quickly on the fly, and they've been coming out at the lunch times and the dinner times. We want to open up with some of those questions. So is that right? We take the first half for some bigger questions, and no question is bad. You can feel like, hey, this might be a dumb question, this might be insensitive. We work with insensitive people all the time.
It's true.
And so I wanted to start with one question to you all, and then you can ask any question, and the three of us will field them together. How's that sound for the kickoff?
Great.
Awesome. So my question to you all is this. So many folks, when we, Chris and I, speak in churches, and Alex is well with us now, it comes out afterwards, sometimes in the lobby, someone's kind of hanging in the background, and then like there's the shaking of hands and the goodbyes, and someone can get see them kind of lingering around, and they're waiting until the room clears out. And they say, so, my nephew's been in prison for 10 years, and their voice is kind of quiet, and they start telling a very important story, and you can tell their church doesn't know about this. Pastor doesn't know about this. There's great shame. And so what we've wanted to do at Underground Ministries as we equip more and more churches is to not say, hey, we're going to pair you with someone, which we're getting really good at, but to first start with what we're calling a Lazarus inventory. How many relationships with folks in the tombs are right there in the church, in the pews, hidden with shame because there's so much pain and they're not sure they can bear even more rejection. There's the rejection of judgment, but there's also the rejection of really putting your heart out there and everyone's saying, and then moving on, and there's no response. And so what I'd like to do is practice a little bit of the Lazarus inventory with y'all to start off. So how many, just raise of hand kind of stuff to start off, how many folks here know someone, and that could even be 3 degrees of separation, know someone who has been through the courts, jail, or prison system in America? All right. How many folks know someone directly? All right. Hands down. How many of those are like a neighbor? All right. How many of those are an extended family member? Wow. More than I would have thought. How many of those hands that were raised, is the person still incarcerated? Okay, so a lot of the hands we saw were folks that have been, they've done a stint in jail or in prison, but they're out now. All right, of a lot of those hands that were up, how many, what's the question I want to ask? For how many of you is that kind of a secret or something you don't talk about a whole lot? Okay. And maybe for the other, how many of those are stories that are just kind of, it's been beat to death in our whole family system or our church community? They're just exhausted from like maybe engagement, enabling, burnout. Is that the story for any hands that were raised? No? Okay, interesting. Of those who raised a hand, does any one or two people feel like sharing a little bit of the story of a loved one, a family member who's been through the justice system and what your experience was with either community or your church in being part of that or not being part of that? Anyone want to risk it? In the back.
Yeah, so my cousin worked for a company that transported like hemp across, and he drove a truck filled with hemp products. And he was arrested because an undercover cop smelled weed and thought and said, well, you're transporting weed across state lines, and this was kind of, and he was kind of made an example out of because it was a new kind of thing for the laws to be dealing with. And I think this was in Idaho. And I definitely think it was better because my cousin is a white man that he did not deal with quite as much. I mean, his company had his back and all that stuff, but he was arrested right before my grandmother's funeral. And so our family, a couple of us were talking about it, and we were like, we're not going to share this with the elder relatives. So that was kind of our family little secret for that time. But he was not incarcerated very long.
How's he doing now?
He's fine now. Yeah.
Good to hear.
He's living in Colorado, and he has a new job.
When I was growing up, I had an uncle and aunt and cousins that lived near us, and all of a sudden my uncle disappeared, and then the aunt and the cousins moved away, the house got sold. I was never knew what happened, but I do know that when he did come, eventually show up and lived in our garage, and then he would disappear like for 3 months and come back, and that went on kind of to the end of his life. And I think I was a teenager before I figured he'd been in and out of jail, mostly around DWIs and parole violations and things. I don't know what the original thing was. It took him away for 2 years. So it was never taught. I was like, you know.
A lot of secrecy around it.
Yeah. And like my other cousins, we were just at a family gathering. They didn't even know that part. Mm-hmm. I don't even think his own granddaughter knew that he lived in our garage. Mm-hmm. So.
Do y'all think it would be helpful if these kind of conversations were part of your families or churches more?
Yeah.
About that this isn't like some big shame, the big family fuck up that we don't talk about, but if this was more at the center, situated with the cross and with the center of our faith, if the church was like eager to engage forgiveness, grace, repair, resurrection. That's our hope. Is that we want to align those things, not just say, well, we need to go out and also remember these folks out on the margins, but we want to position that at the center of our story, especially in the Christian story. So that's some of my questions around the Lazarus inventory, and we can go into that as well as more stuff percolates, and I'm so moved again by Chris Odie's sermon the other night to know that we have this as well, that we have these stories that have not surfaced and need to eventually. Chris, do you want to share a little bit more with where that's a little bit of where, I guess you already said it in that sermon, I just want to hear a little bit more.
Ask away, what do you want to ask?
Why haven't you talked about it for 20 years?
Shame. Easy, that's a simple answer, shame. Mm-hmm. After graduation, Neil moved back to Florida, his family was all there. I was the one who brought him back to Washington. I was the one who convinced him to come back home. And so there was the shame of, what if I hadn't done that? In the sense that, yeah, it probably still would have happened, but at least then his incarceration would have been closer to home. So there was a weird twisted shame and guilt in that. Not that I could have prevented it. I didn't feel like I could have prevented it, but I also felt like I'm someone who's always prided himself on being able to read people. And so the sense of failure in that regard, how did I not see this coming? How did I live with this person? How did I willfully ignore, you know, warning signs that in hindsight, all of a sudden, I decided I should have seen in some weird, twisted way, making it about me. You know, I will never forget the sense of terror of seeing the front of our house in the newspaper or on the TV news. You know, wondering about our own physical safety. I walk around with all this privilege all the time. I get that. Like, I totally get that. And I pretend that's not there. It was empty, pretty much. It's all good. But in that moment, like, it did, that changed how I look at police officers that day. Mm-hmm. I've never been as comfortable around them since then as I was before then. Mm-hmm. And in Tacoma in particular, I tend to avoid when possible, which is weird because it's not even like my, you know what I mean? Like, it's not even that traumatic for me in some ways. And yet it had that much of an impact. I can't even imagine what it would have been like had I not already had all those advantages and privileges going into that. But yeah, shame and guilt. Those were big ones. The big reasons for it. That sense of failure that I should have somehow seen it coming or done something to prevent it or whatnot. Misplaced sense of responsibility. Fears around, back in the day, I mean, fears around, you know, I never ended up going to the trial, but I was on the list. And the idea of having to go through that and being, you know, eternally logged in there as that experience was oddly crippling.
Can anyone relate to some of that? Family members? Mm-hmm. Members of the community?
So I have a cousin who had untreated mental illness, and so because of our conservative Christian upbringing, the whole kind of extended family, we grew up together, but we didn't certainly talk about that. And to this day, we don't know when he's in prison or not because the family's ashamed and that sort of thing. And my own part in it is to say, I didn't really have a relationship with this cousin before he started his incarceration and in and out. And so then I kind of didn't know where I fit. Like, I was like, he literally hasn't heard from me in years. Is it super weird for his pastor cousin to like become buddy-buddy now? Like, is that pejorative, maybe, I think was my fear in that. And then he'd live with his parents, and then he'd be back in, and then he'd, you know, have a job for a year, and then he'd be back, whatever. So to this day, like right now, I don't know where he is. And I have maybe some guilt about like not continuing a relationship with him when I think, I mean, I just don't know where I fit, I think, maybe, in that matrix.
Yeah. One of the stories I wanted to tell yesterday, it's probably better today, is one of our very first One Parish, One Prisoner congregations, maybe the fifth or the sixth. It was a very progressive ELCA church, and so they took no convincing. Mass incarceration, we're it. We want to do this. It took no kind of, they had no fears at first. Once they said yes, and then when one of the women who's like the leader of a lot of the justice committees, she's like, well, I want to be the team leader, and she signed up. And then we did the orientation. We paired their team with someone coming home. And we said at the beginning, like, if you want, now that you know their name, you can Google them.
Yeah.
But we encourage you not to. Because what if we could all Google your shit?
Yeah.
Would you want us to? And so how much better that can happen through storytelling rather than just like, well, I found this one article in the, you know, in the Everett Herald about like you and your family and gross. but it would be better if that came out through a relationship, right? Like you, there's going to come a point in your relationship. And so she emailed me and she said, so I did what you told me not to do. I Googled. I said, yeah. And he had, I'm just really struggling with it. I said, there it is. Okay. And what were the charges? I don't know. I've known the guy for years. I've just known so many folks I can't keep track of their sins. And I'm not that interested anymore unless they want to talk about it. And she said, well, there were some domestic violence charges there. I said, yeah. She said, well, I have some history with those things. Do you want to talk about it? Maybe I should. So we go out for coffee. She tells me a long story about growing up in a Lutheran congregation. Her father was the pastor, and there was daily ongoing domestic violence in her home growing up. And both against the kids, but definitely watching mom get hurt. And the shame and the tight secrecy of this. And this person was also a leader in the denomination, probably the synod, now that I learned more about ELCA's architecture. And she started to speak at length. We were like 30, 40 minutes were going on. And at one point I could tell, as sitting with folks in juvenile detention or prison, it felt good to be able to talk about this with someone. And so I kind of asked the question, knew the answer to it, of like how she felt being able to tell the story right now. And then we reflected on, isn't it interesting, the only reason, I'm like, who was the last time we talked about this? I haven't talked about this with anybody. So how long have you been going to this church? We've been members about 30 years. So how many like prayer groups and Bible study groups have you been part of? And, oh, all of them. Interesting. So what's interesting to me is the only reason we're here talking about this is because we are in a new relationship with someone coming home from prison who has a shared history that they can't hide. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that the charges of folks in prison can unlock the safe boxes, the black box inside our churches? And if God were wanting to get at the wounds hiding in our churches, might this be the best Trojan horse, the secret way to unlock churches, to heal the wounds festering inside our whitewashed sepulchers?
Amen.
And so I say that not as a gotcha, but as how many wounds are hiding in churches that have no way, the sermons are just washing over them and not getting in, right? All the fellowship hall and the coffee and the summer retreats are not getting in there. How can God maybe bring the keys to unlock what's underneath the surface of churches through our friends in prison? And those charges might totally resonate with our stories. And now we have permission to talk about it. At that same church, months later, they had a domestic violence and safety in the church talk. They're like, oh, we can start talking about this. And lo and behold, there's resources out there that love to help churches do this. Another person came forward and he said, I could really connect with our guy coming home because I've never told anyone this. I've been going to 12-step meetings for the last 30 years, but I don't tell anyone at church that. But now that the whole church was loving someone home from prison, it was safe for other people to come out of the congregation and say, oh yeah, I've got some stuff too. Mm-hmm. And everyone could like clap, but he had that shame. And so I like thinking about how much mutual healing and unlocking happens when a church can go into a prison or welcome someone home from prison for our own liberation.
At the risk of being simplistic, something that I have worked with and pondered with many congregants over the years is the basic idea that, because as a pastor, people are always telling you their stuff, whether you want them to or not, whether you know them or not. But trying to help people understand the difference between confidentiality and secrets. Mm-hmm. That confidentiality is helpful, but secrets are toxic and damaging and almost always used to hurt either ourselves or others or both. And the shame that comes with secrets and the destruction that comes with secrets and with not being able to or willing to face them and unpack that as a community. Mm-hmm. Because as Chris said, I mean, it's honestly rare that I will go someplace and speak that someone does not come up to me afterwards and share some story. And inevitably, it is not a story that the wider community has been trusted with. And perhaps the wider community has not earned that trust. And so that makes sense. But it's still not helping that person heal at all. Chris brought up something early on, not intentionally, but I don't know, maybe Holden just cues me for this because I think about it anyway, but I was thinking about how one of the other pieces to obviously the work I do in the location, the context in which I do it is very male, very masculine. And I talked about that some early on, that, you know, I work in a male-identified prison, so I'm not trying to I'm not trying to ignore the women's facilities. I just don't have that first experience. But something that I've really come to appreciate working with the guys inside has been working with and wrestling with them on notions of what I like to refer to as non-toxic masculinity. That there's so much toxic expressions of masculinity, not just in society as a whole, but in prison. You know, it's just the DNA of the place. It's not the incarcerated population. It's the staff. It's everyone, regardless of their background or what they come in with. It's just this place in which all of these tropes and stereotypes around anger and violence and control and repression of emotion and all of these stereotypes are just like heightened all the time. And kind of related to that, something I've really appreciated working with the guys has been on the outside as a pastor, I never really cared about, like, I always found things like Mother's Day and Father's Day to be kind of weird days to bring up in the church. Like, you always have the congregants who really want you to do something special for them, but it just kind of feels like, this is weird, and there are people who are having broken feelings around this, and relate like, there's all this stuff that you don't seem to understand. Anyway. But talking about fatherhood in the prison has been amazing. The last couple of years with the guys, all we've done on that day is really just sat around and talked about what it means to them, what they've learned. And some of these guys are in there for crimes that they committed involving their children. I'm on a bit of a tangent, but I think it's related to everything else we've been talking about. I know it's related to everything else we've been talking about. The other day of the church year that I found incredibly meaningful inside that I never would have thought about in the same way on the outside is All Saints Day. And the notion of recognizing and giving thanks for those who we have lost. Because one of the things that I've come to realize about the experience of incarceration is that you very rarely get good goodbyes. Healthy endings are so rare. Even, you know, not just from death, but also from release, from transitions and transfers. I mean, during the last 2.5 years, many of my guys have been cohorted, sequestered, segregated off from each other based on where they live in the facility, which means that for some of them, it's been 2.5 years since they have seen some of the men who were their strongest supports for the last decade. And they have no way to communicate with them, even though they are physically in the same facility. They're separated by, you know, a few hundred yards and doors and walls and guards. And inevitably, then people leave. And then there's no chance to ever say goodbye. There's no chance to ever, you know, like, it's such a simple, basic thing that we as human beings, I think, take for granted. The notion of being able to say goodbye to someone. You know, we build ritual around it when someone is dying. In congregations, we build sending rituals and things like that. Mm-hmm. Something that we did early on with Living Stones, actually, once I realized that, was we made it we made it a deliberate practice that every week I would ask at the beginning of worship, does anyone either know or suspect that today is their last day as a part of this community? Because so often the guys don't know they're being transferred elsewhere, but they have a hunch frequently. And so if they do, then we would always take a moment during worship to do a modified laying out of hands and sending ritual for that person. And as I always tell them, the absolute worst case scenario is that we're wrong and we just bless you twice, and that's okay. But it was amazing to me how, you know, people use the expression of, like, you know, water in the desert. And that was the response. Like, I wasn't sure how they would respond at first, the first time I brought it up. And it so quickly became one of the guys' favorite parts of worship, was being able to have that opportunity to bless someone, to send them on their way, and to have a very tangible way, in a healthy manner, of recognizing and saying, you mattered to me. My experience of being in this place was made healthier and better because we connected. You know, if you go to our website or if you watch the video again, you'll see some of those blessing rituals in there. And like, I think for the rest of my life, I'm going to look back on that simple little motion, that simple little act as probably one of the most important things that I was able to contribute to in there, was helping these guys wrestle with ideas and values around what it means to say goodbye and to be able to move forward in a healthy way.
Yeah, we rediscovered these rituals in a new way. A few of the questions we've heard this week are about employment. We can talk about that for a few minutes if you like. I love talking about employment and some ways that we can engage that locally. Other questions, is anyone interested in exploring the employment for a few minutes? Show of hands.
Okay.
Yeah, go for it, Melissa.
I just don't want to forget our school to prison pipeline. I'm a teacher in an alternative school. My name's Melissa Johnstone. I work at a 100% free and reduced school. It's re-engagement. Many of my students have been disconnected from school. They were dropouts. Many have kids. Many work to support siblings because their parents have been deported. Many just decide they need something different because they don't learn in the traditional way. I also have 30% homeless students. Big picture is a learning philosophy that's international, but it's basically meet the students where they're at and start with a relationship. You have to remember that if their needs aren't being met, you can't learn. If you're not getting fed, you're not getting shelter, you're not being loved, there's no possible way for you to learn. So we start by loving them up from where they're at. That includes coming in with bracelets, which you see a lot of. There are still some teachers who read the files of students. I don't do that, because that's gonna set a wall up right away, right? I'm gonna have these expectations and these stereotypes of you. So I don't ever do that. Because you came here to me for a reason, and I'm going to give you that second chance. Mm-hmm. So we need mentors in the schools. You need to tell your children to accept kids at school with the bracelets and talk to them. Meet them as human beings, not as the bracelet. Because they're all there for a reason. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it's the system that they're in, and it's all about survival. Some of the kids had no other choice to steal or sell drugs because they need to survive. Or be in gangs because that's the only family they've ever known. So just try to remember that and keep that in your heart, that this is an individual person that just needs your support and love to get on the right path.
And can you talk about how that ends up the school to prison pipeline, like from where you're at to where they're at? What's happening in between here?
Traditional schools are predominantly constantly kicking kids out all the time for anything. Girls now are the hardest hit because they want to come in a tank top. Tank tops we know are comfortable. Why are we going to kick kids out for that? Because men cannot control themselves, right? It's ultimately about a man saying, you're distracting. Why shouldn't a girl be able to come in leggings and a tank top because she's comfortable? But getting punished and kicked out, then that's the way you're seen. Oh, that's the bad kid. And the teacher's in the teacher's lounge talking, oh yeah, I've got that one too. Oh my God. They label these kids. What else is the kid gonna do but live up to your expectations? You call me bad, I'm gonna be bad.
Yeah, Melissa nailed it right there. It's just, we have a pattern of kicking kids out. Mm-hmm. And that right there, the school, is the distillation of our whole societal impulse. That's what prisons are just when you get to adults. It's that society is like the school that says, oh, you've created a problem. Instead of how do we heal it, how do we fix it, how do we work it out, how do we find out what's going on, we remove you. Goodbye, you're disposed. Alex has a story about this.
I just want to speak on it real quick. Finding alternatives instead of going to suspension. because when you kick a kid out of school, that's a perfect recruit, and there's people out there waiting for those kids. It doesn't just have to be with gangs. It could be the drug world. It could be sex trafficking or whatever. They're waiting for kids who are not in school. Like, you're the perfect person.
Yeah, so, well, and kind of feeding off what you both said, like, it's, I don't think I'm saying anything that everyone here has not experienced or thought to some degree, but it's short versus long-term thinking. It's the immediate impulse, for example, the suspension or something. In the short term, you can convince yourself that it makes sense. At least a lot of people can. But it loses sight of the bigger picture of what the repercussions of that are. And like what the ripples will be, what comes about because of that. And like, you know, the work, for example, that one parish, one prisoner does, you know, any of this kind of branch, or even the work that we do going inside, it is important, it is valuable, and unfortunately is necessary. It is, in the bigger picture, so much more work than have we as a society been willing to put in sufficient time and energy and love into earlier in the system and meeting kids and working with folks. You know, I'm not saying this to downplay anything that we do, but societally we're really, really good at going for short-term fixes. And then kind of slowly later realizing, oh wow, there's so much more work we have to do now because we weren't willing to deal with things earlier. We weren't really willing to wrestle with the situation. We weren't willing to provide opportunities. We weren't willing to do all this stuff. But yeah, it took time and energy and effort, but my God, it would have been so much simpler in the bigger picture.
The racial inequity also is very clear in education. I'm a teacher, right? And so, you know, one of the phrases is white kids get dots, black kids get cops.
Mm-hmm. Get dots?
For the same exact, get cops. So for the same exact behavior in the classroom, a white kid is more likely to be like, oh, we need to talk to your counselor and, you know, see what's going on with you and how to help you. Whereas, you know, a BIPOC student, same exact behavior, probably dots. And,
yes.
A lot of, and they make it a big public thing too in a lot of schools. Bring the cop in, take the kid out, put it, show the kid going to the squad car. You know, I mean, if you want to talk about the story.
White kids get what?
Doctors.
So I don't know if you were here on on Monday when I shared about getting a tag in sixth grade, tagged as a gang member. They made a file on me. So that file followed me to middle school. So when other kids would get suspended or detention, because I had that file, my suspension and detention was a right to juvenile hall.
This is the school to prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's it.
If I got suspended or detention, even for missing an assignment one time, they called the gang specialist at the juvenile hall and they would pick me up, take me to juvenile. Which ended up working out because I got my GED in there.
Yeah, it's good that we're talking about these, making these connections, because it's one thing to think, wow, this big prison system, how do we undo that? But the prison system is just what we're all doing in our communities writ large.
Yeah.
And so we're all okay with it because it just feels natural, because that's what we do in our schools. That's what we do in our communities. And so if we can examine that in the micro, we can see how this American prison system built and how it can interrupt it and undo all the tributaries in our communities. Yes and yes.
I'm trying to put in context of my church. That's my context of engagement. And in Sunday school, at the age of kindergarten, you can tell which kids are going to be, you know, they come from homes with addiction or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And what I come across, and I still don't have a good answer for, is we rely on all volunteers for our positions as Sunday school teachers and such, and they're not equipped, and they don't know how to handle behavioral situations that, and so they start to tag, you know, like, that's the naughty kid, or, you know, that sort of thing. So I guess personally I'm wrestling with that. Like, I have the knowledge and the skill set, and I'm the one in front of worship, so I can't be working with the kids. And you know what I mean? And so I just don't know if anybody has thoughts about it within the church context itself, which is not unlike the school system, which is, it, by kindergarten there's naughty kids and there's good kids. And not by use of my language, but that's how kids are talking about other kids.
Right.
You know?
It's trauma-informed teaching.
Yeah.
And culturally responsive. And so you could just make sure that everybody reads those books.
Those
skills.
Tags don't only follow the person that was tagged. Haley is my child and does have my mouth. So when she's a little outspoken, she was told that they knew who her dad was and who her family was and associated her with growing up in a gang-filled environment. So right away they started, oh, you can't wear ripped jeans. You can't wear a certain color belt. You can't wear a shirt that has a cross and Jesus on it. Because although growing up it was viewed as gang culture, it is now just culture. And I think we would know if our child was in a gang. So we, you know, I allow my daughter to wear Dickies because it's just culture now. But to the school, when she was seen dressed like this, they told her that they knew who her dad was and knew who she was around, so tagged her as, you know, someone to keep a lookout because of who her parents were.
Well, all the people, teachers or security guards at the school saying this, I already made them my friends, so.
He won them over.
I won them over.
Yes, and yes.
Haley, you're awesome. Your dad's awesome.
Did you hear that? Say it again.
You're awesome.
Thank you. She said thank you very much.
And then Dick's got a question next.
Good question.
Almost always, punishment doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's just throughout our whole society, and I bet lots of people in this room probably feel pushback about that. No, you know, punishment, we have to do that. But most all the time, punishment doesn't work. It makes it worse. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with the fact that our society here in America is kind of built on, you know, this vengeance idea?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because as long as we got that, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. I'm going to build on that for a little bit. Oftentimes, we see alternatives to incarceration as feeling, we can look at them as they're kind of pie in the sky or idealistic. And I think this is a pie in the sky. This is idealistic. This is not sustainable. This is insane. This is fantasy land going on right here. So what we have in America is the epitome of impossible and unsustainable. And it's not pragmatic. It's one of the largest budget items in both federal and state and county governments. We can't afford it. And it's a poor investment. And so this is normally the tack I take when I talk with some of my conservative friends. I don't talk about God's love. I don't talk about redemption. I don't talk about healing. I talk about this is a shit investment. And we're getting no returns on our investment.
I do the exact same thing when I go to congregations. Like when, because I'll know that I'll run into someone and I'll see that look. Like in the class afterwards or whatnot, I'll see that response. And you know, if they're not going to hear that piece of it, then you got to hit them where they are. You got to meet them where they are. And you know, someone who may not be responsive to it blows my mind and it saddens me and sickens me that I'm sitting in a church and this guy is not able to hear me talk about grace and talk about, you know, literally quoting Jesus. But what Chris is saying is right. I mean, I mentioned during my sermon on Wednesday, I mean, it's going to cost the state of Washington somewhere around $3.5 million minimum to keep this college friend of mine incarcerated. You're never going to convince me that that's the best use of that money, even for him specifically. Even when I believe that he is still dangerous, I still believe there is some better way of approaching that system. There is some more efficient use of those resources and of that human being. Because that's the other thing, is it's this giant waste of not just finances, but, you know, physical space and resources and talents and passions and hobbies and stories and all of these things that are just being locked up because it's hard and uncomfortable to actually deal with it.
So I want to touch on what we're saying right here, how this is building. We don't have a lot of time, but I'm going to try to connect some of these dots as concisely as I can. I'm wearing my favorite shirt today, which is Abolition is the Future. I used to hide that. I thought that if I talk about abolition too soon, people will not stop listening. I'm thrilled about abolition, but it needs a few definitions and a little bit of a conversation. Yeah. Abolition is not what folks on evening news want to make us afraid of, thinking like, oh, if you just tear down the prisons tomorrow and it'll just be run amok. No, abolition, for people of faith, I see abolition is the same thing as eschatology, as we're setting our hopes on something greater. It's not to say this is going to happen tomorrow. When we talk about end times, we're talking about the kingdom of God's goals. We have a long game going on. And what we're, the first thing with abolition is we're taking our imagination away from saying, well, prisons are normal, we always need them. Maybe we need to reform them, to saying no. It's not going to take a decade. It might take 50 years, it might take 80 years. But we need to divest from saying a failed, hellish punishment system is not the answer. And whatever energies we're going to put toward needs to be towards creating the world that God dreamed us into being with and what might be possible. So it's a first, it's a switch of our allegiance and our imaginations. It's not to say, oh, tomorrow we can just close the prisons. That's not going to happen. So it's changing our imagination, our allegiance. The second part is redefining what justice is. Right now, I don't call our legal system the justice system, because that's not my definition of justice as a Christian, as a person of faith. Right now, it's a criminal punishment system. And there's a lot, how many people have heard of restorative justice? Great. How many of you have read a full book on restorative justice? There's a lot out there. I recommend this. It's called Until We Reckon. I've read about 10 books on restorative justice. None of them come close to this. This is brilliant. It's written by Danielle Sered. She's a practitioner in New York, director of Common Justice. She is doing this. They are not just working with low-level crimes or with civil disputes or with kids in juvie. They're working with the highest level of violent offenses in New York State. And they are finding that victims, if they're only given, do you want seek the maximum sentence as justice or nothing, what are the victims going to want?
Maximum.
Max.
Yeah, it's something or nothing, we'll take this. But if they're saying nothing, where prosecutors are going to pursue the highest number of years of throwing the person who hurt you into a big box? Or what if there's some more things on the menu? What if the person doesn't get off scot-free and has to answer and answer to you a little bit? And there's some mediated meetings where you get to not just be weaponized in the courts with your tears so that we can just throw them away, but you can ask questions directly. And where they have to be part, an active part for the next 5 to 10 years of repairing what would the harm that they did to you and your community. She says, by and large, the majority of victims of violent crimes want that when they're actually listened to. And so victims are oftentimes used as an excuse for a state-run punishment system to throw human beings away and say, we're doing this for the victims, and we buy it. We think that punishment is care for victims, but it's not. Nothing is restored. The victims get worse. Nothing is better. All they're just dangled a little fantasy of revenge. If we really throw that human being away, you'll feel better. So they show up in court because they're told and primed by prosecutors and movies, if we just get some revenge, you'll feel better. They never do. So here's the story where this came to bear with our prosecutor. There's a gentleman that signed up to do one person prisoner. His name's Gabe. Gabe was down for about 33 years ago. He took someone's life. He was 21. He was high on cocaine. Not to take away his responsibility, but this is the story. It was a pet store stick-up. It went really bad. In years of trauma that we're going to talk about in a second, exploded when the knife point stick-up went bad, and once he started stabbing, he didn't stop. He took the woman named Roberta's life. She was a young mother, newly married about 3 years prior, had two tiny little kids, smaller than my kids here. He went away from prison. I've gotten to know this story later on. I got to know him as the leader of like the Mentorship Club, one of the highest praised groups in the Washington State Department of Corrections. He's an amazing mentor. He's gone through a slow process of participating in restorative justice groups, mentorship groups, healing, just maturity. He's 21 and high, and now he's like 55, and he leads all the gardening and vegetables into prison menus kind of stuff. He's just gone through an incredible journey of healing and transformation. The head of the Seattle Clemency organization took on this case and said, this is a shoe-in. I've never seen someone more deserving of clemency. Right before going into the clemency office, he was putting his reentry plan together. So I said, even though you don't have a release date, get your reentry plan going. Clemency Court will need to see that. So we signed him up with a one person prisoner church. Right before he went to the clemency, the family is notified only 30 days before the date. There was an uproar of very, very angry letters that showed up. And the lawyer said, we need to pull out. Like, the feedback of the victims and the victim's family weighs very heavily in clemency. We only get one shot, we're going to lose. And so they withdrew. So for the next 3 years, this one person prisoner team has been in limbo with Gabe. And this crime happened 30 years ago in Skagit County, where I live. And so I've had to have conversations with the prosecutor about how do we bring conversations with the victim's family. As I've read the victim's angry letters, I started to put me in a crisis, because I've been working with folks who are incarcerated for so long, wanting healing, wanting restoration, wanting resurrection for them. I don't get to always hear the stories of the victims, because most victims are right there in jail too, by the way. There's a myth that, like, there's just victims out there and the bad guys are in prison. Most of the victims of crime are also in jail. I'm sure you can imagine the stories, but this kind of like victim-perpetrator binary, it doesn't exist. The cycles just go round and round. When I read this family's letters, I was heartbroken, though, because I heard the anguish of boys growing up, that they lost their mom, and that as soon as they lost mom, dad had to work two jobs, and so they lost dad, too. So they grew up on the streets, and that they were in and out of after-school programs and aunts and uncles and neighbors, and they lost both parents. They broke relationships with their dad, and now they're not very good places, and they're probably on their way to prison soon as well. And then I was talking with Gabe, and Gabe's story, as he started opening up, is that once upon a time, he was 5 or 6 years old, and his parent was murdered. See the cycle? And so when little Gabe, his parents were murdered, the state probably arrested the murderer and threw him away in prison. What did that do for little Gabe? Little Gabe got worse and worse and worse and worse, and then he ends up paying that pain forward, and he murders someone. And then there's two little kids that are now growing up. And so what I'm trying to talk to the prosecutor about is, what happens when those very hurt young men pick up a gun and might have, let's say they had a school shooting in a month. Are they still the victims that we need to protect from Gabe? Or are they now the monsters? And so this victim perpetrator bad guy dichotomy just doesn't make sense. And we need to have, if we're going to put millions of dollars into something, we need to have processes that restore. And there's blueprints here about helping victims and perpetrators of specific harm, specific crimes, begin to share their stories and begin to find ways of repairing. And so that cycle doesn't continue. How many folks would like to see millions of dollars invested in procedures that restore and end cycles of violence? How many people want to continue to double down with small reforms and adding more trainings and more guns and more buildings and new facilities that are more safe in a long 50-year project of confinement and punishment? No. Guess what? Everyone in this room, based on your hands, you are all abolitionists. Settle into the term. You are abolitionists. Don't let anyone scare you off of that. If you think that we need something better and something different, and you don't want to just keep playing with the punishment box toy, you're an abolitionist. And it's fun to start reading about it.
What was the name of that book again?
Until We Reckon. I'll leave it here. Even if you just sit down in a bookstore and don't want to buy it, and you just read chapter 3 called In Praise of Accountability, I realize I actually believe in accountability. Prisons don't hold people accountable. They throw their bodies in a box, but they never have to have them reckon with their story or their harm or the people they've harmed. And so, this is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book.
Chris, you probably know this better than I can't remember. I think it's in Norway where they really take restorative justice really seriously. And they'll have, and we're talking capital offense kind of stuff, which is, the hardest stumbling block for people on dealing with it. Yeah, they do therapy work for everyone involved, right? So, victim, family, the person who did the crime, but they will have that person living amongst the community, right? So they don't send them away. They're living in the community as they're going through therapy and all that kind of stuff. And it's a really powerful model, and so antithetical to what we automatically think of in our culture. And we are a culture that worships violence.
right? That's part of the problem, right? So guns are so appealing to us as a culture, the cowboy mythology, all these kinds of things. So it takes a lot of imagination and a lot of prophetic work to break out of this worship of violence to then move towards actual, true restorative justice versus retributive justice.
Absolutely. And to put restorative to resurrection, and then we're going to get into the dissents. What's happening right now?
Oh, Dick had a question.
I'm sorry, Dick.
It follows, I actually had a story, but I'll just go with the question. My Susan was wondering about this, but it follows your situation here to some extent. Minnesota, we have a gentleman, I guess back in the 90s, and we couldn't remember his name, David, I think, who took an axe to his parents and killed his parents, and I think his two of his siblings or both. And he is now at St. Cloud State Prison, which is near where Susan lives, and where we live, and where Susan goes to work. And he is now, during this time that he was there, at least he was running the pastoral programs. He's now, you know, in his 40s and 50s, but he's running the programs there.
Yeah, play the drum, just like on the press right there.
So
keep an eye on the moment.
Alex has a microphone on it.
So she was asking whether they would,
that was restorative justice out there.
Right. Whether they would, you know, whether that would be not specifically us to take on, but you know, a person to work with. And my reaction was that when you're in your late teens, I think when he did it, possibly even 16, but late teens at most early 20s. You know, the male brain especially is off the charts, or can be, even if you're not going to be, you know, in prison. So a lot of people in their 30s and 40s and 50s, they have almost no memory of that kind of attitude. They have a memory of the event possibly, but not of the ability to do that again.
So we wanted to, I know there's at least a couple other folks who want to ask questions and stuff, but I also know that we want to tackle a few things before calling it a week, and we only have a little over half an hour left. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about ways in which individuals can be involved. Mm-hmm. And I promise we will come back as well and have some more opportunity for conversation. Something that was said just a second ago sparked a thought in my head that I did want to bring up briefly, and that was just, I think one of the disappointing pieces for me during the pandemic has been the inability, the unwillingness, the whatever of so many individuals to make the connection between their own frustration with short-term temporary confinement or quarantine or isolation, and then not understanding just how horrible the punishment of incarceration is. It amazes me how many folks with the same breath could, pardon me, bitch and moan about, you know, a week or two of being stuck in their own homes with their own bathroom and their own kitchen and whatever else, and then not understand just how hard it would actually be for someone to be legitimately incarcerated. You see, you follow me? Like, does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I had baby COVID when I had it a month or so ago, but I was at home. I had my own bathroom. I had access to the outside. Yeah, I couldn't be around my family, but they were there. I had, you know, food being prepared for me. That was what I wanted, or at least could deal with at any given moment. And that still sucked. Like, it still was awful. And so when people talk about, you know, the punishment of incarceration, so often folks will act as though being away is not somehow hard and awful by itself. The Norway thing that was brought up earlier, you know, like watching, there was some video, I think it's a series on Netflix, and I hate the title, it's called like The World's Toughest Prisons or something like that. It's just like, oh, come on. But the Norway one, I did watch that episode, and it was interesting watching it and how the guys who were there, you know, to an outsider, especially to an outside American, we would look at it and be like, oh, this is so easy. what they're dealing with. But they would talk very openly about that psychological piece, the piece of being separated from loved ones and how hard that is, just in and of itself. And yet, culturally, we seem to feel like there needs to be more. Like, we need to make sure that it is as punitive as possible because somehow that will deter. And the truth of the matter is, it's not that it doesn't work. We have decades, centuries of proof. We have numbers that are ridiculous to demonstrate it doesn't work.
Touch the trackpad on the laptop.
Okay, so talking about going in, talking about the tombs, talking about resurrection, all that stuff, and now I'm going to speed up my voice because I know we only have about half an hour at most. So the work that I do with the Living Stones Prison Congregation is one example of a way in which individuals, faith communities, can and are involved in places of incarceration. It's not the only one, but it's one that is valued and valuable. I think I mentioned before there's some brochures there. Please go ahead and grab one just so you know how to check us out and all that. There are many ways to be involved in going into the tombs, though. Depending on who here, who here lives in Washington? I'll start with that. Okay, at least a few do. Okay. Every state's going to be a little different, but there's going to be some commonalities. In every prison, there's going to be someone who is responsible for the religious needs, spiritual needs of the individuals who are there. We will often refer to it as a chaplain. In the state of Washington, they're actually religious coordinators because they coordinate religious activities. But there's going to be someone like that in whatever facility. That person's going to be a Department of Corrections or a state employee who is overworked, probably has some sort of training in theology, but very seldom gets to actually act upon it, and will frequently be acting as more of kind of like a bureaucrat within the system. Yes? No, that individual will be responsible for the spiritual needs of everyone within that facility. So, for example, I spent 5 months as basically the chaplain for one of the units here in Washington, the Twin Rivers unit at the Monroe Correctional Complex. And that meant that, yeah, I did have some involvement with the Christian activities that were there, but it also meant that I was responsible for the self-identified pagan groups, when the Muslims would gather for Juma on Friday, the various Jewish groups that would gather, the Buddhists, you know, everyone who was going in.
Chris, what's some examples of things that aren't even spiritual? What's the variety of kind of programs or groups or classes that come into facilities?
It all depends upon the facility and who is willing to go in. The sad truth, and in some ways good truth, but it's more, is that the majority of the programming that happens within our state prison system is brought in by folks from the outside. It's brought in by volunteers. It's brought in by individuals who are working for the local community colleges. But it is very seldom driven by the DOC, by the Department of Corrections itself. And so as a result, what programming is available is highly dependent upon where you are and who is able to get there. So in the state of Washington, Monroe, for example, does pretty well in programming because it's close to where everyone lives. Airway Heights out by Spokane, similarly, it's got a decent population center there that can provide a lot of opportunities. If you find yourself at Coyote Ridge, if you find yourself up out towards Forks, there's a lot less that's going to be available because there's a lot less of people who are willing and able to come inside. But when people do come inside, some of them come in as religious volunteers who are, you know, involved with a faith community, either doing a Bible study or the equivalent thereof for their spiritual practice. But there are also individuals and opportunities for folks to come in who are artists, who are, you know, leading yoga, who are just doing a book club. I shouldn't say just a book club, but like a non faith-based book club. There are groups and individuals who come in leading 12 steps, various forms of that. Mm-hmm. Folks who come in doing theater. Volunteers who go in working with what almost every facility has some version of a clothing closet, because ultimately a certain percentage of guys and women are going to be released homeless. And so there's an opportunity there to put together and pack up clothing so that they will have something for when they get out. Going into the tombs is, it's hard. is an opportunity to serve, but to be perfectly honest with you, the success stories that we have relative to just the pain that we witness and try to minister to, they're out of whack. And so part of going in is being willing to accept that at times part of your role is going to just be there. You know, in seminary, one of my professors would talk a lot about the accompaniment model of ministry, of pastoral care, that oftentimes the best thing that we can do for another human being is simply to be there. And it may not feel like enough, but it is often the thing that they are most in desperate need for, is just someone who will be there to acknowledge that they exist, that their pain is real and that it matters, that someone has witnessed to it. And so for a lot of us, when we go inside, we don't necessarily do so thinking we're going to fix it. It's more about being there with someone and helping them survive and find other opportunities to grow so that eventually they can move on to something better. The truth of the matter is there's a certain percentage of guys who are never coming out. And so programs like OPOP are amazing and wonderful, but if you're a lifer, you need other ways to heal. You need other opportunities and resources to find meaning if you're going to spend the rest of your life inside.
Chris, do you know some lifers that wouldn't mind some letters from the kind of folks that come to Holden Village?
No one would mind a letter. Like, I mean, that's one of the crazy things is we get so awkward and weird and stupid in our own brains. Like, so many of these guys, like, most of that awkwardness you're feeling, it's all you, with all due respect.
Raise your hand if you wouldn't mind writing a letter with somebody.
What's the context?
What's
the context to write a letter to somebody?
I know someone that Alex and I know someone we can talk about, and I'm sure you know some lifers, and I'd love to follow up with folks right now if you want to sign up as we wrap to get some folks connected.
There's also the prison project for if you want to specifically work right to people on death row, which is kind of the bottom of the bottom of the system.
We have a module right here, the Lost Art of Letter Writing, that we showed you a bit of the video for yesterday. And I would love it if a lot of folks came away today in the next 10 minutes as we wrap talking with Chris or Alex and I about two different folks to write, and then we can get you plugged into this module right here as a support to give you some resources, as some guides. We'll get you the addresses because there's some of the gates of Hades you got to get through to get your letter in there. I'm sorry, go ahead. So letters.
No, I was just going to say, I think one of the other things is that the majority of individuals, especially those who are working within the prison system in some sort of programming capacity, because every prison is going to have someone responsible for religious services and also someone responsible for other volunteers, other activities. And frankly, most of those folk who are in those roles are desperate for help. They're there because they care. Like when I talk to people who fall back on the reason that they do the job is because of the benefits package, it's never the people in those roles.
Yeah.
That's not why they go into it. They go into it because they have a heart for service and they're trying to find some way to serve in a very hard situation. And it is incredibly rare for them to turn away a volunteer because there's never enough and there never will be. During the pandemic, depending on who I've spoken to about it, the estimate right now is somewhere between 70 to 90% of the volunteers who were going in beforehand are gone. I mean, imagine in your congregation if 70 to 90% of the people who have stepped up and done things for the last 10, 20, 30, 50 years just stopped doing it. Like, that's what we're facing right now, is this huge, incredible void. But it's also an opportunity, because it means there is this opportunity to bring in something that you care about. And I promise you there is going to be someone on the inside who cares about it as well, and may not even know that they do yet, but given the opportunity, will find it and latch onto it and thrive with it. You know, it might be, there's always a way to work within this incredibly broken, toxic system. There's always some way to develop some sort of program, some version of hope, and find some way for folks to be able to contribute.
Does anyone have an idea that's kind of been percolating as Chris has been talking about? Like, I wonder if
I could do this in a prison.
So I think about the Parkland kids after the 2017 school shooting. These are teenagers who basically set up an international worldwide protest within several weeks, and they use social media, right? So I think that for me personally, I would have to say I don't have time based on personal things, but I can go and tell people in my parish, or I can post on social media the good work you guys are doing. I can be a vehicle that would take me very minimal amounts of time to just push on your guys' message.
Well, and that's legitimately true. Like, I mean, all of these organizations, our organization, Underground Ministries, were always in need of additional funding, frankly. But when it comes to spreading the word, some of our best advocates for Living Stones over the years have been folks who've never actually been inside because of either health concerns or other things going on in their lives. But they've done a dynamite job of spreading the word about what we do to other individuals and bird-dogging other folk who can become a piece of the solution. There's always some way to contribute to this.
Alex wanted to share a little bit about Carlos.
Oh, now you turn it off.
Can you hear me?
Look. Carlos Avalos, my little buddy, I met him when he was 18. He was 17. Yeah. 2012, Clallam Bay, up in the corner of Forbes. Mm. They sent him to prison before he turned 18. He went in with a 4-year prison sentence. And in Clallam Bay, a lot of the guards are, they like to bodybuild, like to take care of themselves, but they're assholes. And so Carlos was this little skinny Mexican kid from Wenatchee. And this guard was just picking on him. He's like, I don't know why you're working out. He's like, you're not going to get big like me. Like, I don't know why you're working out. Carlos like, well, part of my program is mandatory and it's how I take care of myself. And so this guy would just pick on him, flex on him and everything. Carlos had enough. Carlos took a pin, stabbed him 16 times, chest, neck, arms. Nothing major, but he got stabbed. So Carlos had enough of getting picked on, felt helpless. So stabbed this dude. This dude's buddies came up, the rest of the COs, and they beat the crap out of him. This was right after, 2 days after the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. We all got snatched up. I wasn't even there. I was in my cell. We all got snatched up. We got taken to the hole. We got pepper sprayed. I got pepper sprayed. I got taken out of my cell. Stripped, handcuffed, dragged down the stairs. Carlos was being treated poorly after that. They would skip his meals for days at a time. They would ship him across the state without his parents knowing or anybody knowing. He continued acting out. Took a pen to another cop's hand in Shelton because they wouldn't give him his belongings, his books. And yeah, he started with 4 years. He's never getting out now. He's been in the hole ever since. He's been in there about 9 years. 8 years?
He's looking at decades more. They've added to sentences.
They added to it. They won't let him out. His last incident was about 5-6 years ago. And it's because they're treating him poorly. He got picked on. He got tired of being picked on. He's never getting out. To me, he's still an 18-year-old every time we talk. He's like, hey, dog. He's like, you believe in mermaids, right? And so that'll be the conversation. But like, yeah, I mean, we could talk about it. He's like, well, let me tell you why I believe in mermaids. And so that he'll go on this whole story. It was Thanksgiving. I was talking to him. And I said, what are you guys getting for Thanksgiving in there? He's like, oh, I don't even care. I was like, why? He's like, because I'm already dead. Mm-hmm. So, like, he's still a kid. He hasn't fully grown up, but that's somebody you guys could write to. He's a sweet soul.
He's been in extended isolation for 8 years. Just imagine what absolute human disconnection does. But as he finally got a therapist at one unit, he started doing better. He started granting me visits to go into the hole, to IMU and visiting him, getting letters. He's really smart, and he's getting much better, and he's learning to catch himself. He's like, I was making a sharp,
or a knife in my cell, but I caught myself and I snitched on myself and I told the guards that I've been making a shark and I handed it over. So he's his own healing and restoration is happening. And it would be great if he started calling Alex and I next week and said, I got all these letters from, you know, this guy named Ron? You ever met this person named Emily? And was getting letters from some folks. Come speak to us afterwards. Chris knows a lot of folks as well.
He's got somebody who writes him, and I was talking to him. He's like, hey, Doug. He's like, this guy, I don't know, he's trying to convert me or something. I was like, why? He's like, because he's just getting me to write these scriptures. And I was like, well, how do you feel about that? He's like, I don't know, man. I was like, well, do you feel uncomfortable? He's like, nah, that's my homie. And then I talked to him a week later. He's like, hey, man. He's like, I effed up. I did something bad. I was like, and right away, I'm like, oh, man, what did you do? He's like, I ate my honey bun. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I told myself I was going to go on a diet. I've been saving it. He's like, but I was just looking at it. He's like, and I ate it. I was like, dude, you scared me. Like, you said it like you did something wrong.
Jesus. So our last few minutes here, there's folks like Carlos that you can write and we can connect you with. Couple more of final options. Mimi asked us to share as well that in this black folder right here, there's four folks that Holden Village has had incarcerated relationships with. She said, I'm so glad you guys are all here. There's a little bit of a bio, and she's put some Holden postcards right here that you can write if you want to just write one off today. And that would be a great point of connection if they write back. Some folks are saying, well, I don't want to have my address. It's a great place. We tell one person prisoner teams, use your church address. That way your personal residence is not exposed. That way you have to go to your church. Well, I don't really go to my church anymore. Great, it's a good reason to go to the church, pick up your prison mail, and that they know that that's you're connected to a community in a town. Lastly, how many of you all belong to a small group, a congregation, that might be interested in doing something like One Parish, One Prisoner, where you're not alone, and this could be a two-year journey of reentry and trust building and talking about addiction in here? How many folks belong to a community, a congregation, that might be interested in this?
Well, Chris,
yes,
I'm now on a One Parish, One Prisoner team with my church.
How has that gone?
Good.
Are you going to get to know some folks in your church a little bit more?
Yeah, a lot better. I mean, everybody at that church is, that's our family, so...
So we made these for this week, and there's a whole stack right here. Chris, could you pick up a stack, both of those, and Living Stones? We encourage you to take some of this stuff with you and to show. So you're not saying, oh, I met this interesting stuff at Holden, it's hard to explain. That's why we made these. You just go right to the website, and there's videos, there's ways to connect. We'd love for, especially the ELCA is really primed for this kind of work with us, especially in Washington State. Outside of Washington State, we're creating ways where you can use some of that Lazarus inventory we were talking about at the beginning, and build your own pairing and enter an intentional journey of coming around them and their family and having much better conversations together. Emily.
I just want to lift briefly something about the resurrection journey that hasn't been said, and that is being a part of foster care systems is often a really tangible way for churches to be engaged with families who are incarcerated, because and you get to work with kids, and there's so many ways. I mean, I'm a big advocate for foster care, and I'm a part of a program that connects churches. So if you want more information about the foster care system, it's really the preventative model in terms of what we talked about, that pipeline. And so I just want to name that as one of the resurrection pieces that is, I just hadn't heard it named yet.
Absolutely.
And adding to that and the restorative model, Brian Stevenson gives a story about a guy he was working with on death row, and they tried everything, but he was going to be executed. And Brian Stevenson was there with him and asked him how he was doing, and the guy said, you know, everybody's been so nice to me today. The guard said, hey, can we get anything for you? Can we help you? Do you have everything you need? Can we get you some pen and paper? Can we get you, what kind of food do you want? And what he said to Brian Stevenson was, more people have asked what they can do for me in the last 24 hours than they have in my entire life. And that really speaks to where are we putting our priorities? Where are we putting our time, our energy, our money, right? Where's our faith? And it really comes down, it's got to start to begin.
You know, along those lines, if these are just sort of shift, please. I wonder about, well, Chris, with your the goodbye ceremonies or rituals that you were talking about, You know the one for consecrating the spaces? I really wonder how that would go for the prisoners themselves are going around. Because you know how that's a call and response kind of thing. You bless room after room after room and all around. In a way of kind of going through the Hades and actually like blessing the gates and all of it.
Yeah, transforming it. There's a really great book called A Different Kind of Cell, I highly recommend, written by a Trappist monk who is in a 28-year relationship with one of the highest violent individuals in the United States of America, where they built a whole separate unit for this guy. He was so violent and murdered two guards. Over 28 years, that person not only went through a healing and conversion, but became a Trappist monk blessed by the monastery, and then that IMU unit became a hermitage, even though he would never get out. And so to think
exactly
with that kind of a mindset is hopefully the imaginations that we would have. We've got materials. We're here till tomorrow, like a lot of you all. I just, on behalf of Alex, myself, and Chris, I want to thank you all for coming. And I'd love it if Alex, Chris, either of you could close us in a word of blessing and sending.
God is good.
All the time.
All the time.
God is good.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Most holy, good, and gracious God, we have engaged in blessed conversation this week. You have encouraged us to look into our hearts. You have encouraged us to look to our neighbors and see humanity where we so often do not. We ask you on this day, O God, to help us to carry this experience with us from this village, that we may walk every day being open to the possibility of connecting with others and being a piece of your resurrection in this world. Bless those who have been with us throughout this journey. Bless those who were here for a day or two. Help us when we walk out of this space to be mindful of those who cannot leave the places that they, for now, call home. Help them to feel your presence and peace, and help us to be workers in your vineyard. We pray this trusting in your holy, good, and gracious name, and together we say, Amen. Amen.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Seriously, please take some sort of brochure or something just so we can feel like that happened.